This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show.
Well, hello everyone, it's Nate. Welcome to episode 403 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And guess what, peoples? Got another great conversation for you today, this time with the Boxmasters, featuring J.D. Andrew and Billy Bob Thornton, taking us through their history and memories with vinyl and 8-tracks, making era-themed albums like 66 and 69, the artwork of Jim Marshall and the prints that decorate the Boxmasters studio, playing at the Grand Ole Opry, owning Frank Zappa's couch from the Utility Muffin Research Kitchen, and lots, lots more. So, when you get a moment, dial up the Boxmasters on any streaming service. Their new album, 69, is very cool, very unique, and J.D. and Bud's vision of what recording an album in 1969 would sound like. Now, for those of you new to the Boxmasters, I gotta tell you, their music is so well-crafted and recorded. I know of at least a few audio engineers that use Boxmasters recordings for system and sound checks in the tuning and live room. That's how gorgeous their albums sound. And hey, if you like what you hear, the Boxmasters, there's vinyl and tour dates too at theboxmasters.com. And also, please note, there is an extra 30 minutes of this conversation available only to show patrons at patreon.com/vinylguide. People who help support this podcast always get extra stuff. This week, it's an extra 30 minutes of our conversation with JD and Billy Bob. It's also commercial-free and high-resolution audio. So, to those of you wonderful, generous, and no doubt very handsome people who support us on patreon.com/vinylguide, thank you, thank you, thank you. And for the rest of you, please consider becoming a patron of the show, patreon.com/vinylguide. And thank you in advance for your support. And finally, if you're new to the Vinyl Guide podcast, welcome to the show. Grab a seat, get comfy, and please follow us for free in your podcast app. We have over 400 other episodes and interviews available to enjoy anytime with the likes of Marc Maron, comedian, actor, and podcast pioneer, episode 400. Jason Bonham talking about his father and playing with Led Zeppelin, episode 383. Chris Shiflett of Foo Fighters, episode 382. East Bay Ray of the Mighty Dead Kennedys, episode 355. Kenny Jones of The Who, The Faces, and The Small Faces, episode 339. Robbie Krieger of The Doors, episode 306. Peter Frampton, episode 300. Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top, episode 293. Saturday Night Live in Portlandia legend Fred Armisen joins us for episode 289, and lots, lots more. Subscribe for free in any podcast app. Scroll, download, listen, and enjoy the Vinyl Guide podcast. And with that, let's get over to the Boxmasters studio and check in with J.D. Andrew and Billy Bob Thornton.
Let's see. Let's make this bigger so we can see. How do I see myself? Here we go.
Is that an existential question?
Yeah, totally.
Look at you guys, right on time. The consummate professionals.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Very thrilled to have you guys on the show here. Now, I do want to talk about the new album. First off, I have it on fairly good authority that both of you guys have boxes of records in your possession, perhaps from your youth, but certainly throughout your history. Is it fair to say you guys are fans of the vinyl format?
Very much so. Yes. I mean, that's the thing. That's the way we grew up listening to records, and we like the sound. We like the experience. We like the process of actually having to go to a record store and purchase a record, go home and unwrap it. And if you even wait to get home to unwrap it, and putting it on the turntable. And it's just the way music was intended to be heard. That was the original thing, you know. And if they still did 78s, we'd probably do one of those. But yeah, we love it, and we love record stores. And you know, I mean, at the risk of sounding like a dinosaur, we wish it was still that way.
Well, there are fits and glimpses of that culture still available. Do you guys go to record stores that much these days?
Sure. Well, I mean, when we can, when we're on tour, you know, we go to Electric Fetus in Minneapolis, we go to Grimey's in Nashville, we go to Vinyl Renaissance
in Kansas City.
Yeah.
There's a place in Amagansett that's right next to the Stephen Talk House. Anytime we go out there and play, you know, we're all in that store. Waterloo in Austin, you know, there's, we don't, you know, it's like the giant one that's here in, you know, Los Angeles, you know, Amoeba, we never make it to because it's,
we closed.
Well, they opened it again though.
Oh, did they? Oh,
but it's in Hollywood and that's like driving to Indiana for us, you know, that's, it's just not possible. So it's like, we don't make it to the hometown store as much, you know, and sadly, what was the place on Highland that was so great?
Oh, Permanent.
What's that?
Permanent Records.
Was that what it was?
Yeah, maybe.
There's Permanent Records. Then there was Gimme Gimme, which is still there in Highland Park.
But anyway, there, you know, there used to be so many great ones here in LA that we used to go to. And, you know, so, but, you know, just to interject, so we made a record a few years ago called Spec, and it was kind of our, you know, that was the first one that we made a new vinyl of, you know, since we'd made them of our first two records. But for, you know, whatever reason, you know, I listened to those, but they were kind of you know, they were so stylized in the sound and everything that it just kind of sounded normal on there. When I listened to Spec, when we got that one, the test pressing of that, and we heard how great that sounded, it was just like eye-opening, ear-opening, you know, and after all these years of making these records, to then hear your record kind of how it's supposed to sound, like how we really want it to sound, is coming off of a vinyl record. And so kind of just this experience that I had while just checking the vinyl to make sure it worked, that it was like, oh, right. And it kind of just changed how we kind of look at the way we record and how just kind of think about making records again. You know, it's like we think about, we need a record that's, you know, 20 minutes per side, you know, so that means, you know, that can only be four or five songs, you know, or we need to make sure it fits, because we want it to sound the best it can. So you can't put, you know, 25 minutes worth of music on it. Otherwise it'll degrade the sound. So it's, you know, just all those things that the bands that we loved and idolized growing up, the things that they had to think about making a record, we do now too. So, you know, it's really a fun thing. It's like, okay, that's the format we're thinking about when we make a record. You know, it's like, yeah, we'll make CDs and we'll put it on streamers and we'll make it available for downloading. But the thing that we're really concerned with is making the vinyl record. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people don't even listen to it. You know, they just get it with the signatures and put it on their wall or on their shelf. But, you know, we're thinking about how does it sound? How is the best way to make that vinyl sound? And, you know, how can we experience this the best? You know,
And also in a time when sequencing doesn't matter to people anymore, it matters to us greatly. I mean, we still sequence our records just like you would if you're making a vinyl. It's like, you know, this leads off side one. The last song on side one is this one. First song on side two is this. I mean, we still think about that, you know, because that was such an important part of things. And of course, you know, with eight tracks, remember eight tracks, when you'd put the eight track in your car and, you know, you had a probably 12 eight tracks in a case that was that giant, you know, because they were so big. And, but if you remember, when you put an eight track in, it would get to the end of it and then a song wouldn't finish. Mm. It's like, and when it clicked over to the other side, then it continues, you know, Walk Away by the James Gang or whatever it was, you know what I mean? And that was such a hilarious period of time when eight tracks became popular.
I still have a Van Halen song in my head that breaks off halfway through because of the 8-track. So every time I hear that song, even to this day, I'm still halfway expecting it to like chunk and pick up again.
Oh yeah. It's so fun. And you know, sometimes the song would end, but the tape, there would just be silence for like, you know, 30 seconds before it clicked over to the other side. Mm-hmm. Which was so hilarious. And then, you know, and then the 8-track would start to drag after a few days. So you'd put a matchbook under it and that helped stabilize it a little bit. And then it got so loose that we had a method in those days. You'd take the 8-track and you would pull the tape out because it got loose. It wasn't tightly wound. Mm-hmm. So you would pull the loose stuff out. And sometimes it would be like 5 feet long. And, but you could actually take the tape and go like this, go pop like that. And it would fly right back up into it.
Yep. Yep.
And it would be okay again for a while.
You had to get that flywheel just right. So with spec, I guess what you're saying, JD, is that's a that was a fundamental change in the band because I mean, the albums prior to that, it seems like there were still themes. There were still acts within the albums. But now you're saying with spec, the light bulb hit that, okay, this we really do need to think act one, act two, 20 exactly. minutes per side. Okay.
Yeah, totally. Because, I mean, there was some of the other records that we did starting, you know, with, you know, Somewhere Down the Road was a double CD. That was like, you know, 30 songs or so, or maybe it was 12 on each one. Boys and the Girls in the World had, you know, 20 songs. T-Surfing, I think, had 20 or 22 songs. You know, it's just a ton of music that we were like, well, you know, we've got all these songs we've recorded. Let's put them out. And, you know, we would still sit there and like we had Dwight Yoakam sequence one of the records because, you know, we had so many songs and we're just not sure about what to do with it. Billy's like, Dwight, you like this kind of stuff. Come listen to all these songs and see what kind of order we should put them in. He sat there for hours playing bits and going back and forth and, you know, what way it should go. And, you know, it made it so that it was easier to kind of focus and sequence, you know, when you're dealing with just 10 songs or maybe 11 or 12, it was, but you know, and it's also, you know, it's just, it's a easier to keep the theme. I mean, we go into each record kind of, you know, with an idea of, you know, what is this record? This thing is this, you know, we'll keep it in eras, you know, like 69, which, you know, is 1969. It's like, what would we do if we were a band in 1969? And, you know, kind of all of them have that kind of, you know, constraint around them, you know, what confines this record to be what it is. And so, having the vinyl format be part of that, you know, really, you know, helps make a cohesive record.
Now, when you go into a project like 66 or 69, where, correct me if I'm wrong, the constraints that you set for yourself is we want to create an album that was like something that was created in 1969. So using instrumentation and the sort of maybe the cultural aspects of 69. Mm. How do you get yourself in that frame of mind to be able to say what is 69 and throwing out ideas that may be 72 or 75?
Well, I've been in Arrested Development since 69, so I'm always there. But yeah, no, we are a band that was really created because of our love of music of the 60s and up into, you know, early 70s also, you know. But, you know, each time we just try, like we had this record, Boxmaster 66, that only came out digitally before Christmas last year because we were too many records ahead and the record label won't put out a million records a year. So that record just had a little bit more of a, I won't say primitive, but a little more raw 60s feel to it. And by 69, they were, you know, the, you know, recording techniques got a little more refined and stuff like that.
The Mellotrons and things like that.
We did use like the Mellotron and different things like that. So it was, it's not hard for us to get in the mindset of those records. And we don't actually do it so consciously. We just go, okay, this is what it is. And it's like they say with like an actor, they learn their lines and then forget them. You know, it's like, don't now make it, you know, feel natural, you know? And so that's kind of the way we do it. I mean, and it's not that this record would, it's what would we have done if we were right now in 1969? I know one thing we would have done. We would have had more hits. but we would have been on the charts in 1969. Yeah. But one way or the other, it's just like our we do listen to things from that era, you know, mm-hmm. maybe prior to doing it, and one of us will come in and say, "Hey, listen to this." It's kind of like that. Like we have a song, for instance, on 69 called Chestnut Eyes. And Chestnut Eyes, not because we intended it, but just because those influences are always in you, you know, and sometimes something will come out, you don't even realize it until you've done it. Once we recorded that song, I told JD one night, I said, you know what, this sounds like a grassroots song. It sounded just like, not just like, but it had that vibe of the grassroots and that kind of melody, you know, and we didn't intend to do that, but it was because we were in that mindset, as you said. Something popped out that wasn't a group that we would have probably picked out ourselves to go, hey, let's write a grassroots song, but it just was. And
yeah, and after the fact we go, oh, we both love them, you know, they're yeah. you know, got amazing songs, and you know, it's you know, for us, it's really like, it's an honor, you know, it's like, oh, we've got a song that, you know, sounds like kind of our approximation of, you know, somebody that's heroes of ours, you know, it's really, you know, extra.
But that was totally subconscious. That wasn't something you set out to do. It's, you realize after the fact, it's like, wow, these people are in my DNA somehow, and they help me create.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's just, you know, we're just proud that, you know, and you know, that's also why we, you know, proudly say, yeah, we are a 60s inspired rock and roll band. You know, it's, you know, it's like, well, because how do you know, everybody wants to have a label for, you know, what your band is, and they're all like, oh, it's country rock, or it's, you know, something, and it's like, no, it's not, it's 60s inspired rock and roll. It's that's basically what it is. It's guys that love the music of that era and do their best to keep it alive, you know. And
there's a good chance that I had been driving around in the car with my daughter or something, going to get an ice cream, and heard Midnight Confessions by the Grassroots that night, and then didn't think about it for another week. But somehow it was like, it's like left over in your head, you know, it's like very few times have we sat down and said, we want to make a song just like Run Through the Jungle by Creedence. I mean, we don't do that, you know, but we listen back to our stuff and we go, hey, that's Run Through the Jungle. I mean, our version of that kind of thing, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And for some of the things, like, you know, we have one chord that's just, we call the America chord, mm-hmm. you know, like it's, I don't even know what it is. It's like a C something. No. Sus augmented something, and it's just like this, you know, anytime you play this chord, it sounds like America, the band
yeah. America,
and so it's like, okay, that's the America chord. Billy will say, we need another chord, we need the because chord, and so, you know, we'll be like, okay, we'll figure out some chord that has a variation on it that kind of does the thing that
Dave Clark Five.
Yeah, so it's like there's things like that that are pieces of, you know, people that we love that we use to, you know, kind of add that special thing to a song. We're not ripping off a song. It's just like one chord kind of evokes the memory of the Dave Clark Five or America or The Beatles. You know, the Beatles, you know, will play an A6 chord somewhere and it'll be like, okay, that's, you know, something that the Beatles might have done.
It kind of gives you a foothold into it to then kind of build from that. And with 69, and 69 as a year of recording was hugely different than 66 because, well, like you said, you have the Mellotron, you have Roger McGuinn's 12 string kind of enters the scene. You've got the influence of Pet Sounds and Sgt. Pepper and various things. You've got the 8-track is now standard in 69 where it wasn't in 66. So are these the sort of things that you added to the arsenal when you went from 66 to recording 69?
Well, I think 66 was not, we try to be pretty tight, but 66 is a little looser, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
69. I think 69 sounds like a more refined record. 66 is a little more freewheeling. You know what I mean?
It's a little more garage rock.
A little more garage.
Yeah. It's like a, you know, a just
less inhibited.
Yeah, kind of. I would say so. Yeah. And we already play on tour like 3 or 4 songs from 66 and have been for the last several tours. But we just never put it out. And it's like, well, the people who come see us, they know these songs. We need to make the record, you know, I mean, we need to make it where they can get it. And so live, especially a couple of the songs from 66 are pretty, what we call ratty. You know what I mean?
they're like
JD said, a little more garagey, you know?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So one thing I've noticed about the Boxmasters is, not a lot of singles, not a lot of, it seems that you guys have always thought in terms of the long play, maybe not the long play album, but the collection of songs. Is that fair?
Absolutely true. I mean, we make albums and don't really think about singles because frankly, for a band like us that has a niche, if you will, or whatever, and we have a, you know, really great sort of like underground audience, you know, we don't really think in terms of making singles to be huge hits or anything like that, because our kind of music, there's no place for it. I mean, the people who buy our music buy albums. I mean, you know, and they may have favorite songs. And if things were different these days, maybe there would be a single that might be bigger, but it's not a time when our kind of music is going to be on the pop channels, on the radio, you know. So, the guys on radio who like to play us are guys like Jim Ladd and, you know, people like that, yeah. You know. We don't go into it. Now, the label puts out one as a single, and all that means these days is they release it before the album's released. It's right. Not really like here's your number one hit with a bullet. You know, it's just that, hey, that sounds like a single, you know, but a lot of our songs, I mean, could have been singles, which goes back into the 69, 66 idea, could have been singles then, you know, I mean, American Pie was a single.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about records and record collections, that sort of thing. Now, Billy or Bud, when you were young, did you have a lot of records around the house? Were you in an environment where that was something that was a musical family? Did you have a lot of music in the house?
Absolutely. My mother, I was raised pretty poor, so we didn't have electricity for, you know, my first 6-7 years. But then once we did, my mother had a record player, and it was, you know, back in those days, you know, the record player, you had the arm on it and you could put like 5 or 6 LPs on there and they would drop after the one finished. Right. And she would listen to music to go to sleep by, you know, and she loved music. So I was listening, you know, she had records. And so I would listen to Andy Williams and Jim Reeves and Ray Price and, you know, people like that. A woman named Timmy Euro, she used to play her all the time. But then I got my first album because she gave it to me because she liked Elvis. So my first album that I owned because of her was the King Creole soundtrack by Elvis. at which I loved. And then the first 45 I got with my own money down there at Paula's record shop in Malvern, Arkansas, for probably 45 cents or something, was I Want to Hold Your Hand. And then once I started, you know, working and stuff like that, I started collecting records. And to this day in storage, I've got a lot of them here at the studio, but in storage, I've got boxes and boxes of records. And I've got my brother who passed away in 88. I've got his records. And yes, I mean, I've got a good vinyl collection. And there are some new vinyls that friends of ours are putting out, you know, that we have. But there's something about putting that needle down on that thing and hearing just a few crackles and pops. You don't want too many, but a little bit makes you feel real good, you mm-hmm. know, because you're listening to a record. And my father, who was not a music guy, my mom was, my father wasn't. And I begged my family to let me join the Columbia Record Club, which was, for one penny, you got 13 vinyl records. and you could pick them out. You look down the list. I had the pictures of each album cover, and I was like, this is like the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life. RCA, you got 8 records for a penny. Columbia, you got 13. So I ordered all these records, and I'm glad I did, because some of them, they had a compilation record of Columbia artists, and I learned some songs that I probably wouldn't have known about unless I got that compilation of some of their new artists. And so The Flock was on there, I remember. Laura Nero, all these people. But anyway, so my dad said, it's a ripoff, you know, and next thing you know, I'm going to be out some money and, you know, all that kind of thing. And sure enough, the deal was that once you got those 13 records for a penny, then they would send you a new record every month that you had to pay more than the price that was in the store.
It's like $20. I remember that.
Yeah. They were expensive. Yeah. And then if you didn't like the record they sent you, then you had to package it up and resend it back, which, you know, when you're a teenager, I would just throw it under the bed or something. The next thing you know, my dad gets a bill, you know, from Columbia Record Club saying, hey, if you got to pay for this stuff or else, you know. And
so we had a way to get around that, because we would sign up for the Columbia Record House and have them sent to abandoned houses in our neighborhood.
Really?
Yeah. And then we keep an eye on the mailbox, and when they get delivered, then yeah, you get 13 records here, 14 records down the block, blah, 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 blah.
That's amazing. Why didn't we think of that?
Yeah. I lived out in the middle of nowhere, so it's like there wasn't any abandoned houses even.
Or mail.
Or mailbox. Yeah, exactly. And the mail guy knew every person that lived in the county, so it was...
you couldn't get away with that. Yeah,
you're not going to be able to sneak an extra set of records out of them.
So what were some of the formative records of your youth?
Well, every Beatle record. You know, the Kinks records, the Animals. But then when I got, you know, past the sort of British invasion days, I became a huge fan of Cream. Like Disraeli Gears was a big record to me. Traffic's record, all of Traffic's records. And I remember, you know, in high school, Low Spark of High Hill Boys and Shoot Out at the Fantasy Factory. And, you know, all those records, the Allman Brothers Live at the Fillmore East is probably my favorite record of all time.
I was just having a conversation about this.
Yeah.
You know, the story of the picture of the cover?
Very well. I have a whole,
hold on
here right now.
All right. We're going to go into the gallery here.
Oh my goodness. All right.
So we're in the
ladies
hallway.
And gentlemen, we're on the move.
We're in the hallway here of the studio.
Yeah. And,
yeah. And Billy has a original Jim Marshall of the cover photo. And then
the back
and the roadies. And then the back one.
And that's just so you know how much of a nerd I am. That's Red Dog.
That's Kim Payne. That's Jodan Petty, Mike Callahan, and Willie Perkins. That's the road crew, and I know them. I mean, that's how nerdy I am.
You're a fan of the roadies.
Important stuff, too.
Wow. All right.
I was good friends with Jim Marshall, and mm-hmm. took that photo. And also good friends with a lot of the guys in the Allman Brothers and their crew. As a matter of fact, Willie Perkins, their road manager, is a great friend of ours and comes to all of our shows in Georgia. And so I've heard the story of the record cover actually by the people who were there. So it's pretty cool story. I mean, for people who don't know it, you know.
Well, tell it for people who may not know it.
Well, they had that great show at the Fillmore East. The album cover is actually not shot at the Fillmore East. It was actually shot behind Capricorn Records there in the alleyway in Macon, Georgia. And Jim Marshall was there to shoot the album cover, and he's trying to get some life out of them. And they're just sitting around on those road cases, and they were in a grumpy mood and everything, and especially Dwayne, they said. And they were waiting on a guy who was bringing Dwayne a prescription of a type of chemical refreshment that we won't go into. But so when the guy got there, you know, Jim's trying to get them to show some life. And they were just, you know, drinking Pabst Blue Ribbon and looking at the floor at the road. And so when the guy shows up and they started joking about it and everything, then they started livening up a little bit. Jim snapped a couple of pictures, and that's the one where he's leaned back laughing, you know, and that's mm-hmm. on the cover. Yeah.
Cause I heard that in Dwayne's hands, he was just handed that batch yes. of refreshments. And so he's kind of covering it and grinning like a school kid, like nothing happened. And that's, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Well, Jim Marshall's taken pictures of me and my family and the band and different stuff over the years. And Jim was a very unique individual. But the thing that was great about him was that he didn't take a lot of pictures. Most photo shoots, they last hours, and they want you to put your hand right here. And it's like, why? Now I got a fist growing out of my chin. What do you want that for? And or they want you to, you know, wear a bunch of rings and go like this. And, you know, mm-hmm. Jim just said, yeah, sit over there. You know, it's like, don't look stupid. Look at me. You know, he was like that. And he would shoot 36 frames. Every photo shoot I ever did with Jim was on an old Leica. And he shot just until the film ran out. And he said, I'm not a photographer if I don't have one good picture out of those 36 frames. And he could show you his contact sheets. The famous picture of Cash giving the finger, you know, Jim took that when he was coming off stage. He showed me the contact sheet. He goes, okay, look at these pictures and pick out the one. And I went through there and I go, there it is. It was so obvious. That was the picture. And the other ones, for one reason or another, they were great, but they weren't that one. But Jim said, I always get one picture out of 36 frames that I know I can use.
Wow. So when did you discover Zappa?
We'll be back after these messages.
There's no doubt about it. Record collecting has become a serious hobby and even an investment for many around the world. So record collectors have to ask themselves how best to protect their prized records and confidently buy and sell with others. There is an option to consider. Vintage media grading at vmgvinyl.com. vmgvinyl.com will professionally grade your record and encase it in protective plastic, so your record will retain its value for decades to come. This is the same approach that comic book and sports card collectors have done for years. Now, I know many record collectors will be horrified with the thought of having their records graded and encased in plastic. And for the majority of records, this isn't necessary. But if you have top dollar records that you need to protect, maybe a super rare album that's languishing on the shelf, a one-off misprint, or a special LP that you want to protect, look up vmgvinyl.com, Vintage Media Grading, and see if this service is right for you. That's Vintage Media Grading, vmgvinyl.com.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay. Grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up. Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside, so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new. Turn a $5 record into a $25 functioning collectible. Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. So, when did you discover Zappa?
There weren't many people in a small town in Arkansas who were listening to the Mothers of Invention. Especially when you're 11, you know. My brother, Jimmy, and I always had a different type of sense of humor than the people who were around for the most part. Mm-hmm. And there was this kid named David Jones who moved to town from Connecticut. So he was fancy, you know, and he knew a lot of stuff that we didn't know down there. But we were already, my brother and I were already clued into the Mothers. And it started by me seeing an album cover in the one record shop, in Paula's record shop there. And it was, I can't remember right now if it was Absolutely Free. I think so. I go, I got to know what this is, you know? Mm-hmm. And I just, so initially I didn't realize as a 12-year-old or whatever, how political some of that stuff was. I mean, I just, you know, cause we didn't know a damn thing about politics, you know? Mm-hmm. I just thought it was humorous and I loved the music and it was so different. From that, I got into the Bonzo Dog Band. I got into Beefheart, you know, and was like a huge fan of Beefheart. And I actually ended up knowing, well, I've had my connections with that whole world since. I mean, Frank Zappa's couch that he wrote his songs on is right here in our tracking room.
Gail's couch. Oh, wow. From the Utility Muffin Research Kitchen. That was the furniture.
Yeah. And he Gail gave me the couch for my birthday 20 years ago. And it's our couch out in the tracking room. And as well as Frank's ashtray that he used. And, you know, he smoked right up until he died. And Beefheart, I knew a little bit. And Beefheart would call me Don, you know, and he would call me sometimes. And we would talk for hours. And I just did a little documentary thing where I was the host of on a Zoom thing with the members of the Trout Mask Replica Band, which was great. You know, Zoot Horn Rolo and Drumbo.
Antenna Jimmy
Siemens, you know, all of them, you know, Rockette Morton, Mark Boston. He comes to our shows every time we play in Oregon. He lives up there.
Did Beefheart sound like Beefheart when he called you? Hey there.
Oh, of course. It was like, well, I always tell people one of the things I thought was hilarious that he said to me in my pathetic Beefheart impression, but he lived up in Trinidad, California. And I said, Don, I was on the phone with him. I said, Don, didn't you say you can see the ocean from your house? And he said, yes, and it can see me too. But he was pretty amazing. And I have a book of his art that he signed to me in one picture, you know, because he's a great weird artist. And those things are worth a lot, you know. And I've got a couple of those things, and they're worth a lot spiritually to me. But
right,
but one way or the other, I was a huge fan of Zappa and the Mothers, and my favorite one of my favorite records of all time of theirs to this day is Weasels. I'm not Weasels Rip My Flesh, but Burnt Weenie Sandwich. There's a song in there, Holiday in Berlin, Full Blown, which is kind of a rock band playing with an orchestra. It's like an orchestral kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we actually have that in our when people come to our shows, that's in our walk-in music. And if you're playing at a place when you're playing at a rock club and they want everybody to drink and, you know, screw around and dance or something before you come out there, a lot of times the promoter will come up to our sound man and, what the hell are you playing? I want these people to drink. You know, it's like, he said, ask the bosses there. It's their choice. So we have some weird stuff in our walk-in music. It's not always just, you know, the latest hits.
Yeah. Now, you strike me as someone that's had a deep rebellious streak. Were you touched by punk rock? Do you have a history of listening to punk music?
Well, I think since, and you know, some people may disagree with this, but I think punk started back when I was a kid. I think The Who were a punk band in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And the Kinks were, yes. Yeah. The Kinks also. I mean, so I think really there wouldn't have been punk bands without bands like that. And, but then, you know, when punk came along, yeah, I was into the Ramones. We used to play a Ramones song, as a matter of fact, in our show when we used to cover a couple of songs. And, I was into the Ramones. And, I listened to a lot of that. Like Wendy O and, you know, different people like that. The Dead Kennedys, you know, I used to listen to. So, yeah. Yeah, I was into punk because the 80s, as you know, were after punk revolution there. It got a little not fun for a while in the 80s.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Name me a Dead Kennedy song that still isn't relevant today.
Yeah, I know, right? Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And JD, you grew up with records too? Are you from the record era?
My mom and dad were both consumers of music. They loved to listen to music, and we listened to a lot of the radio. But, one of the things, I had one of those plastic Fisher-Price record players.
Mm-hmm.
It was like orange and white.
And the multicolor records with the...
Well, I don't remember. It would play regular records. And But it was like a plastic record player that I could carry around. And early on, I mean, my favorite thing was Chipmunks records. I loved the Chipmunks. They're the record where they have the Beatles wigs on and, you know, play a bunch of Beatles and 60s songs, you know, was probably my favorite one. But, you know, all of their stuff back then was huge to me. And also, the Beach Boys were my favorite when I was a kid. I had the Beach Boys Live and Endless Summer, I believe, were the two records that I listened to the most. Especially the Beach Boys Live, because I, you know, for whatever reason, it's like I loved their version of Long Tall Texan a lot. For it just made me laugh. I just thought it was, you know, hilarious and fun. But I just loved that record too. And so, you know, listen to Solid Gold Saturday Night on the local, you know, oldies station, you know, at that point, the oldies were only 10 years old at that point, you know, or less, but it's still funny. I mean, they played a lot of 50s stuff at that point still, but in early 60s and, you know, listen to, you know, special Beatles nights where they just play Beatles songs. There was always, you know, something I'd get super excited about and go tell my teacher at school that I sat up all night and taped all the Beatles songs on the radio. But yeah, it's up until high school when they came out with CDs, I was still just rocking my Beach Boys records and Creedence and, you know, all the stuff. I never really got all that current until high school when I started hearing, you know, what everybody else was playing. But, you know, up until then, it was like sticking with what I liked. And what I liked was, you know, 60s records and Beach Boys and Beatles and Creedence, and wasn't so much into the Stones at that point. That came a bit later.
How ironic.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of funny, but
well, you see why we make a good partnership, because you need the yin and yang. So he was listening to the Chipmunks and I was listening to the Mothers. So it makes an interesting
I like to credit the Chipmunks with my, love of recording, because, they were using they were pushing technology to the extremes to make those records. And it's like, man, that's how I tell myself that I, became interested in recording at a young age, is because they were
interesting. Yeah.
Interesting records early on.
And you sat up with the tape recorder trying to tape the song. So you were already kind of working the dials.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Loved all the technology of playing music and recording music. That's, always something that really gets me.
I totally get that.
But we still stick with the technology of, the 70s. So that's, that's where we are.
So when you moved to LA and you wound up working with, alongside some of the best ears in the business, Hugh Padgham, Bruce Sweeting, what were maybe one or two things that you learned from your time, your biggest lessons working with those sort of ears?
Well, I worked with a guy named Mike Shipley who, he did a lot of Mutt Lang stuff. So, Def Leppard and AC/DC and things like that. I learned how to, one of the important things is to get rid of stuff you don't need. Like, you don't need super low end stuff on guitars. You don't, get rid of that stuff, because all it does is muck with everything else. So I learned how to use filters from Mike Shipley, like in a proper way. Ed Cherney was basically my mentor. Ed won a handful of Grammys for, best recording, best engineered album, like for Bonnie Raitt and some others. And, Ed taught me, basically how to put excitement into stuff that might not have it, and how to really make things pop, like drums, like how to really give them energy and make them exciting. I worked with so many, I got to just sit behind so many of, like the greats, Al Schmidt, I got to sit behind. I had the worst session ever in history working with Al Schmidt. It's like early on, I was working at this junky, not maintained studio that, had classic gear, but it was just all broken down. And so I'm trying to put together a session that Al didn't want to do for a friend of his that, maybe he was getting paid a bunch of money to do it because Al had like 17 wives or something. And it just, everything went wrong. And I'm just sitting there, just a pool of, frustration and, disappointment that I, was the worst assistant engineer ever, And at the end of it, Al's like, hey, shake it off. You'll be all right. This wasn't great, but we got through it and, we'll be okay. So it's like, I just got to see, how people handled working with other artists and, mm-hmm. What was needed. It's like, what kind of, what made people comfortable? What kind of
energy you had to bring into the room?
Some people had certain different energy, but also at the same time, it's like, there's certain things that you kind of just have to have from the beginning. Like some things you can't learn, you can't learn to just have an opinion that you yell or, you tell people like, no, that's not good. Do it again. Yeah. Sometimes you just have to be blunt and say, yeah, let's do that again. Or I think you can do something better. And so you kind of have to be comfortable voicing your opinion, and some folks aren't, and they might do something that gets it by, but sometimes you have to just have a strong opinion about stuff. Mm-hmm. Also why sometimes you don't get called for other gigs.
I know the Boxmasters has played all around the world. playing the Grand Ole Opry, that must have been a pinch me moment there. Yeah,
it was, especially since we weren't a country band and we were asked to play there. So we had to scratch up a couple of hillbilly songs of ours from the old days and do it. And but it was chilling to go out there on that stage. And it's very strange playing there. And, you know, they record it and air it on the radio, or I guess live. And so we were worried because there was so much separation that we couldn't really hear each other very well. And when we listened to it later, it was one of the best recordings we'd ever heard. I mean, they really have it down there. And plus, when you're backstage and you're seeing all the other people there, and like the Oak Ridge Boys were there, and, God, just all kinds of
Larry Gatlin was there.
And yeah, you see these people and, you know, you're there with them and you feel like part of something, and it's legendary. I mean, so yeah, you always get a little bit of a chill anytime you do anything like that. And
I have to say, it's the old Grand Ole Opry, but we did Levon Helm's Ramble at the Ryman in like 2009 or so. And that was one that was the hardest thing I've ever done, because not only was the stage full of heroes, you know, and Levon playing drums, and it's like we went out to go play one song, but the audience was all like heroes of ours too. You know, it's like all fans of Levon's are all other artists, you know. So, I mean, I've never felt like I was going to throw up harder than right before we went on stage at that show. And, you know, I think we did pretty well, but still it was like, it's the magic in that room. You know, the new Grand Ole Opry is, you know, like a purpose built, you know, big old theater out at the theme park. The old, you know, the Ryman is, you know, decades and decades and decades of all, you know, the legends that went on that stage. And, you know, you feel it hard when you're in there. Yeah. And especially when you're in the wings and you're about to go on in that place, it's devastating. It's very, very hard to lose that feeling until you start playing. And then, you know, then it's like, okay, now it's, you know, you just shut up and sing. And it's magical. And, you know, there's been a few places that we've been, you know, we recorded at Sun Studios one time. Something that, I mean, we can never release it because it didn't end up being that great. But just being in that building, it's like, I remember standing in the lobby, just breaking down, crying. It was just, you know, an emotional experience. And, you know, we're going to hopefully get to go to Abbey Road this summer, you know, for the first time. And I imagine that's going to be a pretty, pretty heavy time as well. Just,
wow.
I can imagine. I, you know, you've been there before, right?
I've been to Abbey Road. It's like you just, the hair just springs up on the back of your neck. You can't even believe how it feels in there. And I mean, obviously, because you know what it was.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Look, I'd be thrilled just to sit on Frank's couch. Frank Zappa's couch in the
next time you're over here, and next time you get to LA, come on over. You can even
there's songs on that couch. I mean, there's times that we're like, you know, struggling with something, and it's like we need some ideas, and you go sit on that couch and they just come out.
It's weird.
It's I mean, songs just write themselves when you're sitting there on it. And we don't use it all the time. You know, it's like we don't want that magic to get used up on, you know, stuff. But every once in a while, especially if something's hard, it's like we just go, all right, it's time to go talk to Frank. And it's pretty incredible. So, and it was in storage for a lot of years, and just finally when we got the studio, it's like we had a place to put it. So it's like, okay, it's going right there.
That's amazing. Well, look, that'd be my absolute honor to sit on that couch. I may even have my first cigarette in 20 years if the ashtray's there too. J.D. Andrew, Billy Bob Thornton, the Boxmasters, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide. It's such a fun conversation. And there's so many things I like about the Boxmasters. And the thing that seems to resonate most with me is really the purity of the band. There's an authenticity. It's a pure intent of kind of stretching concepts and aligning the influences and sensibilities. I always liken Boxmasters to another one of my favorite bands, Fountains of Wayne. So I do want to make sure that people are able to enjoy the new record, 69. There's a whole bunch of other records as well. I also recommend Maud Billy. The first one, Boxmasters, I'd say build up to that. Start with 69, of course. The Boxmasters.com, there is vinyl available. It's on all streaming services. And look for the Boxmasters touring in your neighborhood soon. And Billy Bob JD, thank you so much for coming on the Vinyl Guide.
Thank you so
much. Thank you. We appreciate it.
Oh, man, I can't wait. I'm definitely going to make my way over to L.A. I need to sit on that couch. That sounds amazing. And by the way, speaking of sounding amazing, the Boxmasters, check them out. The music is fantastic. The audio quality is spectacular. It's on any streaming service or, of course, you know where you get their vinyl at theboxmasters.com. Oh, and by the way, there is an extra 30 minutes of this conversation available only to patrons of the show, patreon.com/vinylguide. Head up there now, help support the show, and enjoy all the extras. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Share them on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter, put those links in the Reddit forums or the Facebook groups. Talk to your record nerd friends about The Vinyl Guide podcast. Show them how to get a podcast on that smartphone of theirs. That is always appreciated. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.